Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The world of fiber optics is expanding the reach and power of the internet and has the potential to revolutionize our homes and businesses. Fiber optics carry virtually unlimited amounts of data and will radically transform healthcare, education, stores, and the way our cities and towns are administered. According to my next guest, it's a change that will rival the advent of electricity. But she argues it's a tech revolution that America is at risk of missing. Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School and served as President Obama's Special Assistant for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. Her new book is called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan Crawford, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here.
It's really good to have you. And listeners, we want to get you involved in this conversation about the fiber optic revolution. What kind of internet is available in your own city? Should high-speed internet be a right available to all citizens? How do we make that happen? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And feel free to call if you just have questions about this really fascinating conversation. So, Susan, let's start with a basic definition here. We hear cable companies like Verizon, Fios talk about fiber. Tell us what it is. What is fiber and why does it matter?
So, fiber, there's a lot of it, by the way, already running between cities in America and between the continent of North America and other continents. What it is very, very pure synthetically printed glass through which lasers shoot pulses of light carrying information. Once the glass is in the ground, the science of photonics is advancing very quickly. And as far as we can tell, the amount of information that can be sent through glass for kilometers, tens of kilometers, without being encouraged or amplified, is unlimited.
Unlimited. So how does that compare to what's going on now? Well, now we're basically, or the older technology, we're dealing with what? Cable.
Cable, which is hybrid fiber coaxial lines.
Right.
Look, the difference is if you're sitting at home trying to participate in a business meeting, right now using a cable connection, it does not feel to you as if there is just a pane of glass
right
between you and the meeting. You're not actually able to participate. The difference with fiber is this very high capacity, enormous amounts of information allow for human presence. And cable can't be upgraded the way that fiber can to these unlimited numbers of bits. And around the world, and especially in Asia and in the Nordics, fiber connections between, let's say, city nodes and homes and businesses are common. That's the way things work, but not here in America.
And that's what you mean by this last mile, right?
Exactly. Right. That's the most expensive part of any telecommunications network.
From the nodes to essentially my living room.
Exactly.
Got it. All right. So let me put it this way. So I live in Somerville, and my internet feels plenty fast. I watch Netflix, watch videos, upload photos on my phone. I can stay in touch with work, usually. Why should I be concerned about not having that last mile of fiber?
Let me draw a parallel for you.
Yeah.
In the early days of electricity, people thought that having one light bulb was all anybody would ever need. They couldn't imagine that anything else was ever going to happen. Same thing here. You're downloading Netflix, but it's very difficult for you to actually be with a doctor, be in a classroom, be part of anything, exchanging very large files rich with data. There will be new industries, new ways of making a living, new ways of surviving the 21st century, especially given climate change, that will require tremendous connections to homes and businesses, and you don't have that in Somerville.
Wow. Interesting. And I want to actually just get you to describe a little bit where your book begins, because you traveled to South Korea and in 2018 during the Olympics there.
Actually, it was before the Olympics.
Before
it was the August before the March Olympics,
right,
the Winter Olympics. So I was in a very hot ice skating stadium.
Right.
But they were demonstrating to me what was possible with the fiber plus very advanced wireless services that Korea Telecom had installed in Pyeongchang. And it was really something.
So what did you see? What was so remarkable about it?
Well, the idea of being able to take the view of an athlete in an event, be actually with that person, able to feel almost what they're feeling, is extraordinary. And that's what these connections make possible, to slice and dice events in any way you want to as a viewer, and understand and slow down, turn so you can see it again. Mm. Also, I was really moved by the idea there in the Winter Olympics Village of a driverless bus guided by tsunamis of data that are telling it where to go and where to turn. On the windows of the bus, projected images or information about what you're seeing outside, and you're able to, in effect, communicate with the world around you through the windows of the bus. And that's pretty neat, too.
It's extraordinary. If I recall correctly, I think there was a moment when you actually thought you were going to run into somebody, right? And the bus actually did what it needed to do.
Well, and driverless buses are becoming more common in Asia. They rely on these very high-capacity networks, and they would make sense in the Boston area, for example, in the Longworth area, as a shuttle between lots of people and public transit. But in order to do those kinds of things, you have to have very advanced networks in place that are open to many different kinds of uses. And that's another thing we don't have in the United States.
Mm. So talk a little bit about, let's stick with South Korea for the purposes of this part of the conversation. Talk about what they're doing in South Korea that is not being done here. First of all, we were talking about that last mile, right?
Yeah.
They're doing that last mile.
Yes, they've done it. So there is fiber reaching every corner of South Korea. And there are a lot of very hilly, inaccessible rural areas of South Korea.
Yeah.
They assume fantastic wireless connectivity. They never drop calls. It's everything simply works. It's hard to describe the difference in feeling. You never think about the cost of or the availability of access to the internet. It's just there, and it's cheap. Years ago, the South Korean government, with a lot of encouragement from Samsung, installed what's called dark fiber. So that's the glass that I described, but without the lasers lighting it up with data. And it's everywhere, and that allows for a huge retail market of competitors using that fiber to provide services directly to customers. Basically, everything functions in South Korea, and it's not just telecom, it's also high-speed rail and other things the United States doesn't do. And what got me started on this journey was that South Koreans told me that coming to the United States feels as if they're taking a rural vacation. I heard that a few times, and I'm so proud to be an American, and we think of ourselves as so exceptional. It seemed important to me to tell this story in an as approachable way as I possibly could.
It's really astounding to hear that anecdote, though, isn't it? I mean, as a kid, I spent part of my life growing up in Europe. We're talking about the early 70s. In those days, everyone looked to America as,
right,
you know, where this kind of technology was sort of taking root and taking off. Mm-hmm. And you tell a story that's very different now. The perception is very different.
And there are many trends converging here.
Yeah.
So percentage of research and development spending by the federal government as a percent of GDP has gone down by it's a quarter of what it was in 1986. So our commitment to basic research is also failing. And these two things go together, because getting government involved in ensuring that the country remains the most innovative place, that's the way it's always happened in America.
Hmm.
And post-war, especially your childhood and mine, we were the place where new things were happening. New industries were coming, and everybody had optimism about the world ahead. I still have that optimism because I know that American spirit is there, and I know that Americans at their best are never cynical. So we can do it again, but it would take leadership and the sense of a crisis, which we don't have right now.
Well, what changed between, say, the 1970s and now? Was it a sort of lack of faith in this is the kind of thing government can handle and do a good job at helping to lead in terms of the innovation?
It was a misplaced faith in the genius of the private market in infrastructure. So.
Right.
Certainly after the Depression and all the things that happened at that point in our history, nobody would have thought that private industry left to its own devices would provide an infrastructure that everybody needs at a reasonable price. That's just not going to happen. That's not in their incentive package. But we began to believe that in recent decades, and really to think that the only thing that we value is profit making. That's happened. The companies that are selling access to us are doing extraordinarily well and controlling markets and dividing them up. Life is great for them, and I don't fault them. We haven't restrained them in any way. We've completely deregulated this entire marketplace of high-speed internet access, and what's happened then, lots of Americans are left out, services are second rate, rich people are paying through the nose for those second rate services, and then as a country, we are becoming less relevant. Among the OECD nations, 36 of them, we rank 35th 25th for fiber adoption. And that's amazing. We should be looking everybody else in the rearview mirror.
Wow. Well, we're going to talk as we go forward about some communities around America that have sort of taken this on and are doing actually a really good job with it. I'm talking with Susan Crawford. Her book is Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. You can join the conversation if you've got questions or comments about all this. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. And let's take a call from Enfield, Connecticut. Zach is on the line. Zach, good to have you. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, so I got a question. Sorry, I forgot her name, but
Susan Crawford.
What exactly is allowing the fiber to be quicker in the other countries? Because I'm a limited energy system tech, and virtually everything I install is converted from Cat5 to fiber. But the process of converting it with the converters slows the fiber. It's quick across the fiber, but the equipment is still the same speed as it can be. You know what I'm saying? So the internet is traveling across the fiber quickly with unlimited bandwidth, but it's slowed down by the equipment to convert it back to Cat5 or coax or whatever equipment it is. So I was wondering what is in the other countries that's allowing their internet to be faster without having to convert it to something that allows you to access internet, like Wi-Fi emitter or something like that.
Yeah, Zach, I think we got it. Susan, does this get down to that last mile question?
Well, he's actually talking about something even more granular, which is the equipment that's then processing the data that has gone over the lines. And there, I mean, for one thing, there isn't a conversion to Cat5. It is fiber all the way into the building, into the basement. And they are developing equipment that can handle much greater numbers of bits and spew them back and transmit them around. So look, they've got better gear than us, but the main thing this book is about is this infrastructure that we don't have. We just don't have it in the last mile because we haven't upgraded, by and large, to these fiber optic connections going into houses and buildings. But you're right that something that could be affecting this story is the nature of the equipment you use. That's absolutely true.
I want to talk about this eventual move toward 5G, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this is a key part of that, right? The 5G sort of evolution isn't going to happen without fiber, right?
Right. So let me explain this. So 5G requires fiber.
Right.
Without
fiber,
no 5G, because the whole point of 5G is that it's very, very quickly moving frequencies of spectrum, carrying tons of information, but only over a very short distance. So between every 200 feet and every 400 feet, there needs to be a cell where there might have been in the past one every 750 feet or 1,000 feet. So that means a lot of construction of small cells all over the place and much more densely provided fiber deep into neighborhoods. What's happening in America is that the companies that plan to sell 5G are actually only aiming at making more money from their existing infrastructure and selling very highly priced premium wireless services, things like home security and smart city services. They want to have better price control. And 5G will let them do that because it will have lots of information flowing and the operator will be in complete control of which services actually are provided over that 5G gear. Long story short, can't have 5G without fiber. We should be very careful to make sure that we don't give any one 5G carrier a monopoly over any metro area.
All right. Let's take another call. Andy is calling from Falmouth. Andy, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for the call.
Yes. Hello, Susan. I would just call in. First of all, I'm a very firm believer in municipal fiber. I really don't need much convincing of its benefits. But I am looking for some advice to communicate to my friends who are definitely, I guess, more firmly on the side of commercial telecom, essentially how to convince them that we should be shifting to something like municipal fiber.
Mm. Okay, great. Here's the way to do it. That you say, look, you're acting as if we have some choice between the free market on one hand and government control on the other. Mm. Actually, what's happened is we have a series of private governments because these companies have divided up the country and tend not to compete with each other. And they set the prices and they decide who's going to get what, and they also decide not to upgrade. Their goal, which makes sense in the capitalist market, is only profit taking. if a city gets into this, their goal is service. You don't ask a bridge whether it's profitable. It's there to make sure everybody can get across the river. Similarly, municipal fiber is there as a public option to make sure that everybody gets a chance at a respectable life. And it's just like water. It's just like electricity. It's increasingly crucial to life. But tell them that the choice they think they're being offered between a private market and government control is actually false. They're getting the worst of both worlds.
All right. Andy, thanks so much for that call. So this isn't a case where somebody might say, whoa, I'm suspicious of having the government control the means of communication across the internet, right?
In fact, the model that really works and works very well in Sweden and South Korea and Japan is for the government just to build the equivalent of a street grid, just blank fiber, they call it dark fiber, without the lasers in it, reaching every home and business, and then lease that out to private actors.
Interesting. So what stands in
service?
I see. So what stands in the way from that happening right now here in the United States?
Shenanigans. Political shenanigans.
A technical term.
Political shenanigans. In 19 states, it's either difficult or impossible for cities to do this because the state legislature has just declared that this would be unfair to the private companies. And, you know, the companies essentially don't want to compete. That's the trouble. In the states where this is allowed, like in Colorado, purple state, and by the way, this is largely happening in Republican areas. This is not a Democratic idea. 60% of the counties have voted for municipal fiber, and that's a home of a lot of cable. But they just decided we don't want to be left out of the 21st century, and we want to make sure we're paying a reasonable price. We're paying what the service should cost, which really is more like something 25 to 40 bucks is what people pay in Asian nations and the Nordics.
Here's what I'm still having trouble getting my head around. Why wouldn't a Comcast? I mean, let's talk about Cambridge, for example, right? So your one choice is Comcast. But why wouldn't Comcast want to upgrade to fiber to be competitive with the rest of the world?
Why would they? Yeah. I mean, look at it from their perspective. This morning, I wrote a check to Comcast for $107.45 because I get just internet. I don't want a bundle. And that's how much it costs in Cambridge. Right. That's extraordinary.
Yep.
And they're under no pressure from competition. There's nobody else offering service and no oversight. So you add all that up and their capital expenditure as a percentage of their revenues is down this year to 14%. And they're planning to make more money from the same infrastructure. There's absolutely no reason for them to upgrade.
I see. All right. So talk a little bit about towns and cities, a few of them sprinkled around the United States that are actually taking matters into their own hands and making this work.
That's a tale of courage. I got to say, there are 800 places, cities and cooperatives and groups around the country who are deciding that this is worth it. And they're either raising the money or floating bonds. Some communities decide to tax themselves. It turns out to be a very worthwhile investment. It just pays back slowly. So if you're a media company like Verizon or AT&T, may not make sense for you to do this because you need 18% returns every quarter for your Wall Street investors. For the places that are doing this, this is a real point of pride. It turns out to be the number one thing on businesses' lists when they're thinking about moving to communities, whether there's adequate connectivity, not only for themselves, but for their employees who might want to telecommute.
All right. Well, on this subject, I want to introduce another voice in this conversation, William Hiller. He is a town selectman in Otis, Massachusetts. He's serving on the technology committee, and he heads Otis Fiber, the town's municipal internet provider. And William Hiller, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Bill. Nice to hear your voice.
Now, you guys know each other, of course. William features in your book.
Oh, largely.
Largely. All right. So, Mr. Hiller, tell me about the impact on Otis of this project, of the town's fiber project, if you will.
Well, we're still in our infancy. Right now, we have probably close to 300 homes lit up. This is fiber to the home, 1 gig up, 1 gig down. In being a selectman, I don't normally get good phone calls, but a lot of people have called and just expressed how grateful they are to have this service.
And why did you want to take this on? What did you see as so important about it?
Overwhelmingly, the town wanted it. As Susan says, it's in my opinion, it's as important as electricity moving forward. As we go into the future, we have kids from school sitting out in the parking lot at night in front of the library just to do their homework because they need the internet. Out here, if the only means of connection out here is via hotspot. So if you don't have that, you have nothing.
Wow. So what about cost, Mr. Hiller? Tell me about that. How does that work? For a small town, Otis is a population of about 1,600, I think?
Well, we have 1,600 residences. That's homes.
Yep.
So it's going to be difficult, and to be honest with you, we don't know yet. We're so early into this. We're into phase two, actually phase three of 11 phases. And the costs, we have models, but we really don't know. We're running 80 miles of fiber. We have 2,600 some odd poles. And one of the big variables is what's called the take rate. So we have 1,600 potential customers. How many customers we will actually have is a huge question.
I see. So, Susan Crawford, what do you hear in William Hiller's story here about Otis?
He's early in a story. Mm-hmm. We are seeing in countries that are really used to this, take rate is north of 70%.
Wow.
Because it's just viewed as a utility. Of course you need this.
Right.
Because it's unusual in Otis and because there have been delays, the town does not control those poles, and so they've had to wait to get access to them. It's a like operatic drama. Pole attachment turns out to be really bloody stuff. So it's taken a while, and so you know, you've got to accustom people to it and make sure it's offered at the right price. But they're taking the right step, and the town, as Mr. Hiller said, overwhelmingly voted for this at a town meeting, and there are lots of other places in Massachusetts that have done the same thing.
Right. Now, is this something that is more doable in a small town like Otis compared to, I don't know, a larger metropolitan area like Boston?
Actually, it's likely a little harder in Otis because telecom really works on economies of scale.
Yeah.
And if you've got a sparsely populated place with long distances, you really have to make sure that every customer signs up. In a place that has 30% apartment buildings, let's say, you can get an entire building relatively rapidly, and those economies of scale really work in your favor. That's what's made it so expensive to ensure that the middle of the United States gets very good high-speed internet access, because it's expensive to do it.
So, William Hiller, final question for you. In terms of the challenge that you're facing out there in making this happen, what could the federal government have done or should do to make this whole thing more doable? What kind of policies are lacking? Can you give me a sense there?
Well, first, I would really like to thank the governor of Massachusetts and the state. Without their support, none of this would actually happen. We do have some additional funding coming from the federal government, which is certainly going to help. But a lot of regulation. We're seeing extraordinary costs from Make Ready.
That's
probably
the polls.
A fifth of our construction costs were dedicated to getting the poles ready to attach fiber. And then moving forward, operating costs, again, attaching to those poles is a significant expense yearly. Even though we pay for the poles in many cases, we still have to pay to attach to them.
All right. So money, obviously, is one of the big...
significant.
Yeah.
But that's also...
If the federal government could jump in there, it would be very helpful.
Well, William Hiller, he's an Otis Town Selectman serving on the Technology Committee, and he heads Otis Fiber, the town's municipal internet provider. William Hiller, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Really
thanks
appreciate it.
Thanks very much again, Susan. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
So, Susan, you write at one point in your book that once you have the idea that fiber is important, the other steps fall into place. It's only money. But it's a lot of money, right? I mean, I think
potentially, but we spend a lot of money on defense. We spend a lot of money on other things. This amount of money, what's actually happening is that we're losing money as a country by not making this upgrade. We're paying rent to about five companies that are doing extremely well while sort of dumbing down our own populace. Because Americans don't travel, they may not be aware of just how bad the situation is.
Right.
And they're sort of content with how things are going. but it's a tragedy. There is some baby Einstein, some baby Mozart out there who has no access or terrible access and can't get the kinds of support they really deserve to lead a thriving life.
And this really raises the specter of this sort of technological haves versus the technological have-nots, right? I mean, we're really in a situation where that's already beginning to happen, I guess.
Well, certainly in the U.S., and so turn now to China, where they're planning to connect 80% of their homes to fiber optic and 5G, these very fast wireless services. They know that they need to create a giant middle-class market for all of their goods and services, and they see this as part of it, along with high-speed rail. In the United States, we seem content to just leave behind somewhere between a third and a half of Americans who don't have adequate internet access, and the rest of us are paying too much.
Well, that's Susan Crawford. She's a professor at Harvard Law School. Her new book is Fiber, the Coming Tech Revolution and Why Americans Might and Why America Might Miss It. There's a lot more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Susan Crawford, thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for the book, an important subject. I really appreciate hearing from you.
I appreciate being here.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.